welcome to the Symantec Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien, and joining me today are Symantec threat researchers Gillian Cleary and Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be taking a look at our latest research on the topic of mobile app privacy. We'll also be talking about how USB charging cables could be used to compromise devices, and why the US government wants to break the encryption on Facebook Messenger. But first, a few weeks ago we mentioned a new scam doing the rounds by email, which is trying to extort money from people by persuading them that they have a video of them watching pornographic movies on their computer. Well, that pales in comparison to something that was reported this week, which was one of the most bizarre and elaborate fraud schemes seen online in recent years. A Minnesota lawyer last week pleaded guilty to multiple charges of fraud and money laundering. The lawyer, Paul Hansmeier, is one of three behind an outfit called Prenda Law, which was found to have made millions of dollars running a scam where they tried to sue people who downloaded pornographic movies from file-sharing websites. Their modus operandi was to identify and threaten downloaders with lawsuits if they didn't pay $3,000 to avoid the embarrassment of a court appearance, and the trio allegedly made $3 million from the scam. The case has been under investigation for a few years now, and there's been a steady drip feed of information about the operation. Perhaps the most unusual revelation, though, was that they originally started out aggressively pursuing legitimate copyright claims, but then decided to get in on the action themselves by actually commissioning their own adult movie films, purely for the purposes of seeding them on BitTorrent in order to entrap people into downloading them and then threaten to sue them. So there you go, folks. It just goes to show the lengths that some people will go to try and extort money from people online. Okay, let's move on to our main item. Last week, Symantec published a new piece of research on the topic of mobile privacy. Specifically, we were looking at the issue of app privacy. The average smartphone user these days has between 60 and 90 apps on their device. And if you're one of those average smartphone users, are you aware of how much personal information you're sharing with those apps, or what level of access to your device each app has? Joining us here today is Gillian Cleary, who was the principal researcher on this project. Gillian, how did you go about investigating this one?
Well, Dick, the research was aimed at investigating what kind of personal information the popular apps were gathering about us. So I selected the top three apps on Google Play Store and Apple App Store, since they were the most popular apps on an official App Store, basically.
Okay.
And the reason I narrowed it to 100 is because I knew that I was going to have to interact with each application, and I thought 100 was a reasonable sample set. So to begin with, I looked at what permissions the apps were requesting and whether they were pertinent to the app's functionality. And then I focused on what we consider risky permissions, which are those that involve the user's private information. And of those apps that request the private information, I wondered if they had a privacy policy. So I checked for the existence of this. And basically that's led me down the route of checking how many apps link to third-party apps, which privacy policies don't cover.
Okay, so you got yourself an Android phone and an iPhone, and you downloaded the top 100 apps onto each. And what was the next step? What did you do then?
Well, I didn't download them all at the same time. Okay. I downloaded batches at a time.
Yeah.
Because basically to analyze the communication from a single app, it's easier to keep the number of apps on the device sparse, so not to taint the network traffic with other app traffic. So to do this, I installed what is called a HTTP proxy cert as a trusted cert on both the phones.
Okay.
Then as I interacted with the apps, I used a man-in-the-middle attack to intercept the network traffic. So at this point then I'd had collected all the network traffic in separate files for each app, and then I searched each of those files for personal identifying information.
I see. So we're talking about 200 separate apps here. How long did it take you to run analysis on all of them?
A few weeks. Or more than a few weeks.
Yeah. Okay.
So the most time-consuming part of it was the app interaction itself.
Yeah.
So I had to interact with the apps basically long enough to give them a chance to advertise third-party apps or interact with social networking sites. And for games, this would typically mean completing a level and maybe posting your results. Since some games were more fun than others, they might have taken me a little longer to
yeah.
run my desktop.
Okay, so you ran your tests on all of these. What did you find out in the end? What were your findings?
Well, from the traffic I sniffed, I found that the most common piece of personal information shared was the user's email address. I could see that was shared with 48% of the iOS apps and 44% of the Android apps. And then the username was kind of a close second with 34% of the iOS and 30% of Android. And then after that, the phone number and address were shared, but not at all as frequently.
Okay. And just to kind of muddy the waters a little, I gather that kind of may not be the full amount of personal information being shared with apps, because some of them may have shared information due to social media integration. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. So that wasn't what I was looking for to begin with. The research kind of went down that route. Because while I was doing the research, I noticed that a large amount of network traffic was to social networking sites using the various sites' APIs. And I was able to identify what PII was shared with the iOS Facebook interaction, but not the Android Facebook interaction due to certificate pinning.
Okay. So we don't know exactly how the figures with Android could be higher a little bit. It's possible.
Exactly. Yeah. I could see it was interacting with Facebook, but I couldn't see the content.
Yeah. And what's the most common kind of form of social media integration you saw being used by app developers?
Well, the Google and Facebook APIs were the main interactions. And as you know, Facebook Graph API has been in the media widely since the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Okay.
But since then, the Facebook have really restricted the amount of information that are returned from this API, and they've tightened up their review process for apps requesting specific information.
Yeah, so I gather nobody can kind of repeat what Cambridge Analytica did. Well, so Facebook say anyway, with the way they've tightened it up.
I can't confirm or deny that.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the personal information. What about these risky permissions you were talking about earlier? What did you find out there?
Yeah, well, there's a huge amount of permissions apps can request, but my interest was really only in those that access the personal information. So what I found out was the phone's camera is the most common risky permission requested. 46% of Android devices requested that, which I thought was pretty high, while 25% of the iOS devices did. Close second was your exact location. 45% of Android apps tracked that, and 25% of iOS apps. For recording the audio on the phone was another one I checked, and 25% of Android apps record your audio, and 9% of iOS.
Okay, and just to clarify here, when it comes to permissions and personal information, all of these are given with the user's consent. And I suppose some people might say, well, if people are consenting to this, what's the big deal?
Okay, yeah, but who's the user, right? Is it you or is it your four-year-old child playing with your phone?
Yeah.
People often install the apps without reading the permissions, or they don't understand what the permissions mean when they're requested. So when I was interacting with the apps, and in particular games, I was bombarded with ads to install other third-party games. So basically to level up or to gain points in a game or something, I was offered another free game to install. So once I install that, and it's a third-party app, it's not from the same developer.
Right.
That's another privacy policy again straight away. So because of this, I wanted to highlight to the user what permissions they're typically granting and encourage them to consider whether they're really needed.
Yeah. Because I think you found a few apps that requested quite a lot of permissions for what they did, didn't you?
I did, yeah. One that I focused on here was the flashlight app called Brightest Flashlight LED Super Bright Torch. There's loads.
Okay, that's a bit of a mouthful.
There's loads of flashlight apps, but this one, because it requested so many permissions, it prompted me to look at it really closely, because I would have expected it to use maybe the camera flash, the flashlight, that's it.
Yeah.
So I read the description of the app on the marketplace and its privacy policy to determine why it needed access to the user's location or to phone calls. And what I discovered was it did actually use these permissions for some functionality, and the functionality was really far from flashlight related. So apparently in SOS mode, This app can send an SMS message with exact GPS coordinates in an emergency situation. But I didn't try this functionality, but I'd certainly be interested to hear if anybody has.
Yeah.
But because of this, because it did have functionality that used the permissions, it got me thinking that, you know, why are people bundling together several unrelated components in this single app? So I wondered, were they providing functionality to access permissions rather than looking at what permissions they need to support the functionality they provide?
Yeah, and I guess that's a question. Like it's an open question there that we can't really be.
Yeah, no, I can't answer that. Yeah, it's up to those using the app if they consider the functionality appropriate or if the functionality is useful for them. The SOS functionality wasn't useful for me, but I can't say it isn't useful for somebody on the side of a mountain.
Yeah, yeah. okay, what about privacy policies? Does every app have one? And do they explain to the user what information they're giving up? Does that cover app developers?
Well, almost all the apps I looked at did have one. There's 3 or 4% that didn't. But I didn't read all the privacy policies. Some of them were massive, but I noted their existence and read through a sample set. Many of them were very vague. And while what they do with your information isn't really always clear. So, and apart from that, they disclaim responsibility from your data once you enter a third party site or app. So let's say you're using an app and you're directed to install another app to, as I was saying previously, level up or gain points.
Yeah.
That's another privacy policy that you need to read through. So basically everything that you install, you have to read the privacy policy. If you're directed to a website, read the privacy policy for that site if you're entering your data there.
Yeah. So one app itself is an issue, but once you kind of start to get in extra third-party apps, you
can really go down. It's a web of privacy policies.
Yeah. Okay. And who's going to read all of them? Thank you, Gillian. For those of you who'd like to read more about this, you can read all of our research on our blog at semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. And if you want to do an audit on your apps, she's got some tips there on how to protect your personal information and review the permissions on your apps. Now, moving on to our next item that we wanted to talk about this week, which is the rather menacingly named USB harpoon. Apparently, USB charging cables can be used to compromise devices that they are connected to. Bridget has been looking into this one, and can you tell us more about this attack?
Yes, I can. So indeed, it has been dubbed the USB harpoon attack by the White Hat researchers who devised it and discovered it. And it turns, as you said, a USB charging cable malicious, allowing it to compromise a device. So this attack is based on previous research from a few years ago, from about 2014, I think, which was called the Bad USB Research, which was actually presented at Black Hat in 2014. And this detailed how a USB thumb drive could be made malicious and used to compromise a device. And as I said, this attack takes this research another step further. And I suppose the significance of this development is that I think people have become suspicious of unknown USB drives over the last few years, as it has become known that they could be used to compromise devices. But I don't think that is the case with charging cables. I don't think people really make that connection that charging cables could be used maliciously. And obviously people always want to have their phone charged and things. So they're probably much more likely to, unthinkingly use a charging cable, whether it belongs to them or not.
Yeah, I think most people probably just think a charging cable is something quite benign, that it isn't smart in any way. So how exactly does this attack work?
Right, so as I said, it's based on the bad USB research, and this showed that an attacker can reprogram the controller chip of a USB drive to make it appear to the computer as what's called a human interface device. So a human interface device is things like keyboards or a computer mouse or a network card, among other things as well. So for example, the computer could read a USB, or in this case now a USB charging cable, as a keyboard, which could then issue a rapid succession of commands, or as a network drive or a network card even, that can modify the system's DNS settings in order to redirect traffic. So the research, crucially as well, in this attack, the researchers said that they were able to program the malicious charging cable so that power could still pass through it, meaning that it will perform as expected by users. So in that way, it won't arise suspicions by not operating as they expect, by not charging their device. The researchers said the attack will work on unlocked devices, where it can then launch commands that can download and execute any payload. And then they further said that it also is cross-platform, so it works on Windows, Mac, and Linux machines. However, the activity when it's taking place is visible on the screen. So if a malicious attacker is planning to use this kind of attack, they would need to come up with some way of hiding this activity from users.
Okay, yeah. So there's a few steps they need to go through there.
Yeah.
How serious exactly now would these USB type attacks be?
Yeah, I mean, they are pretty serious because they're kind of difficult to protect against, really, and to guard from. I mean, in lots of ways to guard against these kind of attacks, you're relying on good user behavior and you're kind of trusting that, you know, people won't plug any strange USB or USB charging cables into their laptop. And obviously, you know, that's something you can never guarantee. And I mean, the, you know, big thing about USB attacks really is that they allow attackers as well to get onto computers, even if they're not connected to the World Wide Web, like to the wider internet. So devices on isolated networks. And I mean, we saw that kind of activity as far back as 2010 when the USB drive was used to get the Stuxnet virus onto the systems of Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which then crippled Iran's nuclear program temporarily in that, you know, very famous attack. Since then, as I've said, people have, you know, definitely become more aware of the dangers of random USB thumb drives being thrown around the place at conferences and stuff. But definitely this caution, I don't think, has spread to charging cables yet. As you said, I think people think they're pretty benign. So if an attack is developed leveraging this kind of research, then that could potentially be pretty serious.
Okay, so the moral of the story is don't plug your phone into a strange computer.
No.
Or with a stranger's cable. Now, USB Harpoon, this isn't the only thing you wanted to talk about this week, because I gather that the US government wants Facebook to break the encryption on Facebook Messenger. What's going on?
Yeah, so this caught my eye this week as well, and it isn't the first time we've discussed governments asking tech companies to break their applications encryption on this program. But this time the case involves calls on Facebook Messenger and audio on Facebook Messenger, whereas generally we've seen law enforcement, I suppose, looking for, you know, typed messages as opposed to audio files. So Reuters had the scoop on this story this week, and they reported that the US government is trying to force Facebook to break encryption on Messenger so that law enforcement officers can listen in on a suspect's voice conversations in a criminal probe that's ongoing. The case in question is going on in California, and it's under seal, so we don't actually have any details available about it, but reportedly it's linked to gang activity, so, which is obviously a big kind of criminal thing in the US at the minute. And Facebook is reportedly contesting the case. As I said, it is a bit different because where previously in these cases, you know, law enforcement's generally been kind of looking for access maybe to one specific phone, to access messages that are, you know, on the phone or have been sent in the past. In this case, they essentially want to apply, you know, a wiretap really to one individual's Facebook Messenger account. So really they're looking for Facebook to nearly like entirely rewrite the code of Messenger so that they could input what would really constitute a backdoor on the Messenger app's encryption.
God, it sounds pretty elaborate what they're looking for. But so what exactly are the privacy implications or any other implications of this case if it succeeds?
I mean, if it succeeds, there could be pretty major implications. I mean, we already saw a similar case to this in 2015, 2016, where the FBI was attempting to compel Apple to break the iPhone encryption so that they could access the phone of the then deceased suspect in a terrorist attack carried out in San Bernardino in California. Now, Apple were contesting this case, but in the end it was subsequently dropped anyway because the FBI got a private contractor to gain access to the phone for them. So no decision was ever reached in that case as such. So if this case goes all the way to a decision, the potential impact of that would be unclear. Like, if the government is successful in this case, it could probably make similar arguments to force other companies to rewrite their popular, like, end-to-end encrypted services, like Signal and WhatsApp, which is also owned by Facebook and which has more than a billion users all around the world. So if things were to change in that would be pretty significant. And it would be a pretty big deal, as this issue of backdoors and breaking encryption is something we've seen a lot of talk about over the last couple of years, and something that has caused like a lot of disagreement between the tech companies who are producing these services and who say, you know, this is all implemented to protect people's privacy, and then law enforcement who then say they require access to this information in criminal cases. And I suppose the problem that many people have with this concept of backdoors is obviously if you leave a backdoor, you can't guarantee that only the good guys can get in there. There's always potential that bad guys can get access to it as well. And of course, I mean, who's good, who's bad, like that's all in the kind of eye of the beholder as well. So who would be granted this kind of special access? So really it is a potential minefield if this ruling passes. So it's definitely something that we'll have to pay attention to with interest.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the case, that if you know, encryption, if it's breakable for one party, it's breakable for all.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're opening a Pandora's box, really. Facebook wasn't the only major tech company in the news this week, though, when maybe they didn't want to be. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I suppose it kind of plays into this whole, you know, who's good, who's bad, how much influence can we allow governments to have? Google also made an appearance in the headlines when it emerged that they are reportedly working on a censored search engine for China that would blacklist websites and search terms about things like human rights, democracy, religion, and peaceful protest. Because, of course, the internet in China is famously very restricted. And Google actually pulled out of China in 2010, partially due to this censorship, it said at the time. Now, China's rules around censorship haven't changed since 2010. But despite this, Google is reportedly working on a project that they have dubbed Dragonfly, which has no relation to the attack group we discussed on the programme a few weeks ago, to create this censored search engine. And now reportedly some employees, having heard the reports this week, aren't too happy that their work is being used to develop this censored search engine. And reportedly around 1,400 Google employees signed a letter asking for more transparency from the company about this issue and about what their work is being used for. Now, Google hasn't commented on these reports, but I suppose we'll just have to watch with interest and see if they do relaunch in China in the coming years or months.
Yeah, I think that might be the last we've heard about this one. All right, it seems more to come out. That's about all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying the podcast, please don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all the action. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you want to read our latest research, including Gillian's, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic.com/threat/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week when we'll be once again looking at what's going on in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.